And welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk. And this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Mario Cantone.
Oh, hello, Jennifer. Hello, Jessica. I'll just call you JJ.
Yes, that was my nickname. It's my nickname growing up.
JJ?
Yeah, because my middle name was Jean, and so they called me JJ. And now people are going to...
Jean?
I know, it's so... fun fact, in a little off-Broadway show I did called I Love You're Perfect, Now Change, they had these giant checks.
Oh, yeah.
They had checks in the show, and the name on the checks were our middle names in the street we grew up on, so I was Jean Cortland. Which is so like 1940s movie star names. That's what they wanted to call us.
Jean Cortland.
What's your middle name? What street did you grow up on? What would it be?
MacArthur Road in Stoneham, Massachusetts. So Anthony MacArthur?
Oh, starring Anthony MacArthur. What is yours?
I'm a stripper. Mine is Lee Fine.
And, no, that's
my middle name is Lee.
And that's a good name. Lee Fine? Yeah, that's
Lee
a good
Fine,
one.
You know? That's a 40s name, too, like starring Lee Fine, Anthony MacArthur, and Jean Cortland in Murder 2020.
Also, you know, I would stand on a street corner and strip at this point for money.
Yeah, well, so, that's phase four. That's phase four, Jess. You're not allowed to come back to do that yet.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a good thing I'm gay because I might have been like, hey, let me talk to you for a little bit. Come on over. I got some money for you.
And you know how that feels so right to me because I'm from Jersey and understand if, like, when I watch The Sopranos, I watch it with friends and I go, oh my God, the bagel shop. Oh my God, the bridge.
Oh my God.
So,
wow.
Yeah. But you know what? I digress. We are so happy to have you here with us today.
I'm glad to
be here. Right, Ben?
Oh, 100%. Mario.
You two talented kids.
Oh, stop now.
Two very talented girls.
Oh, my God. I'm going to do my New England accent all day in honor of you being here. Mario.
Did you ever have a New England accent?
I did. You know, I still do. My husband laughs at me when I'm tired. It comes out on the letter O. Yeah, on the letter O.
You do.
Yeah. So if I was going to say
Tommy.
Yeah, confident. I know. You have to have confidence.
Confident.
You know,
Dollar.
Yeah.
And people always get that when mm-hmm. they do a movie and the actor does not have a Boston accent mm-hmm. and they have to have one, they mess the A's up and the O's up all the time.
O's. Yeah. Agreed.
The O's. It's all about the O's.
So, Mario, honestly, you are one of the funniest men we know and one of our favorite talents ever with this incredible career. Today, we're not here to talk about that. We don't care. How do you feel about that?
Good. It's just refreshing.
Good.
Oh, good.
That's the general response we get because we're whole people with lives and we like to talk about other things besides ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad. I'm glad that Mario doesn't care that we're not going to discuss his career and that we care about true crime right now more and we have an obsession with it and we know you understand our colleagues do too.
I kind of grew out of it a little bit, but when Investigation Discovery came on, it was murder porn as they call it. It's my favorite thing in the world. I mean, I watched and then you'd watch one of those, the neighbor next door, and it was just like, one more, I'm going to do one more. It was like an addiction. And I had to go out of the house to do things. I was like, I'm just going to watch one more. It was like sick. It was like heroin. It was, you couldn't stop. And they also had some crimes that they, you know, redid on another series. It was one that was, you know, where the person that was murdered was the voiceover. Which was like, I know who killed me, so you will too. Yeah, but it wasn't like, you know, it was a voiceover person. It was an actor.
Well,
I know who killed me, soon you will too. Yeah.
Well, that's the shit of nightmares, and I love it.
But what if it's your best friend? Like, I didn't know Jessica died. And Mario Cantone died.
I know who killed me, soon you will. Check my ass for the DNA.
CODIS. Well, let me ask you this, Mario. I've often thought, like, through the years of being an obsessed true crimer, like, am I a serial killer? Why do I sleep with a knife by my bed if I'm in the middle of the woods? Like, is there something wrong with me? Why am I so obsessed with this? Have you ever felt that way watching your murder porn? Tell us about it.
No. Look, when Jerry was in Seattle a lot and I was home alone, there was a few nights I'd wake up and like, oh, a little scared.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel more afraid in, like, in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah. Like
in a house or I in New York, I'm like, oh, what's gonna happen? You hear a few gunshots out the window once in a while, it's okay. you know, where are we?
It's funny because if we honestly, if you know Citizens app, and I've just, somebody posted about this today. There's the Citizens app that everybody has in New York now, where you're like, you know, I don't have it because that I'll never leave the house. But your Citizens app, you're like, guys, let's go to brunch. Somebody's like, somebody just got murdered though.
Oh no.
Down the street, guys. But anyway. You understand.
But I don't get scared when I watch it. And horror films don't scare me. They do if they're really good. But, right. You know.
What's your favorite documentary, though, Mario?
I don't. Jesus.
Did you watch The Jinx?
Yes, I did watch The Jinx. The doc. What was the doctor that killed?
Well, Robert Durst.
What's his name? Him, Robert Durst. Yeah.
Blew my mind.
Yeah, I watched that a while ago. Did you watch the one about the kid that was accused of being a child molester, football player? And he got off too. I love when they get off because it's like, you know, and that kid in that fucking house did it. That other kid, the family he was staying with, that the son of the mother, he's the one that did it. And that kid was blamed.
And you know what? For our listeners, because we don't have any of our podcasts on video. We just do audio. If you could see the three of Mario and I talk with our hands, I've realized. So yes, does Jen. And so there have been several touchdown moments here, okay? When we're talking about documentaries and the shit that we find interesting. So I feel like you all should know that coming into this episode.
Finally, do you have any theory as to why we actor types or human beings in general find true crime interesting? Or do you not have a theory?
I do. It's probably the psychological aspect of it and the characters within these murder cases, including the lawyers, including witnesses and the victims and the perpetrators. So it's, I think that you're looking at, I think as an actor, it's fascinating, but I certainly think the normal people that are sane that don't go into the business probably love it too. I mean, like a lot of people love it, you know, it's just, it's intriguing. And I've watched so many of them, and The Staircase.
The Staircase.
Mario, Jess and I are so excited, not only that you're here, but because every now and then we do like to do obscure cases like today's case, the Boston Strangler. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah.
You've heard of that one.
Of course.
Not many people have.
First of all, I was young.
You were four. First of all, you're from Boston, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So were you the Boston Strangler?
Yes, I was. I was running around in a diaper.
I knew it.
With a little ruler that unlocked all the doors. You know, he had that ruler, that little like stuff that looked like it was a measuring ruler, and he would break into houses that way. So that was me. I grew up in Stoneham, Massachusetts. My family was originally from Everett, and he was from Chelsea.
Yeah,
Chelsea, Massachusetts. He was born there, and then I think he lived in Malden a lot with his wife, but he also stayed at his brother Joe's on Chelsea Street in Everett. It's right around the corner. I my first 2 years of my life were Chelsea Street in Everett, and he lived across from Luke Road Park on Chelsea Street. He would stay with his brother there once in a while.
I'm sorry, what park?
Luke Road Park.
Okay,
which is right across from which is right on Chelsea Street. It's on the corner of Luke and Chelsea. So yeah, he would stay with his brother Joe, and his nephew Frankie, my cousin Jeannie, was very close with him. They were very friendly, and Frankie was like a great guy, supposedly. But my cousin Jeannie used to work at a beauty salon. She said Albert used to look in the window, and he was really creepy.
Oh,
he would always look in the window at the beauty store and creeping everybody out that way. So they all kind of knew him, and he was a fucking wacko. He was nuts.
Yeah.
So obviously.
Well, Mario.
But that was her. And Frankie was Joe, who was Albert's brother's son. So she knew Frankie anyway. Yeah.
But at this point, would you be willing, Mario, since you have said that you did all these things at 4 years old, to do your own voiceover telling
Yes,
you,
I would.
I just wanted to make sure. That's been on my mind.
Okay. I'm Albert DeSalvo. I know who killed me. Soon you will too. Because he died in jail. They killed him. They stabbed him in jail, right?
Like right after he was in there. Well, we're going to get into our story, but we got our information from Wikipedia. Please donate to Wikipedia, everybody. I've been getting my pop-up windows lately. Please do. Yes, go ahead.
So by the way, his first victim was 62.
Oh,
they
thank you.
It was him, but his first victim was June 14th, 1962.
Thank God you're here. Someone knows what they're doing.
Well, I know.
On this show, we're all experts. So you are, you're a doctor now. You're a lawyer. So is that all right? with you.
Yes. And by the way, he also wasn't convicted of these crimes. He went to jail, but what happened? I mean, he was, why wasn't he convicted?
Well, we're going to get there.
Do we know why?
Yeah.
We got to get there. We got
to
get there.
I'm dying to know.
All right.
I don't want this to be 8 episodes. Let's move it along,
that's,
girls.
That's what we said. We said that with the Zodiac. We said, listen, this is going to be the highlights because we don't have 9 hours with you. So here we go. There's a lot of info. So let's go. All right. This is the story of the Boston Strangler. The Boston Strangler is the name given to the murderer of 13 women in the Boston, Massachusetts area during the early 1960s. The crimes were attributed to Albert DeSalvo based on his confession, details revealed in court during a separate case, and DNA evidence linking him to the final victim.
That was just like, 5 years ago, right?
2013, I think. Long ago.
7 years ago. Yeah, no.
In the years following DeSalvo's conviction, but prior to the emergence of this DNA evidence, various parties investigating have suggested that the murders, sometimes referred to as the silk stocking murders, were committed by more than one person. Initially, the crimes were assumed to be the work of one unknown person dubbed the Mad Strangler of Boston. Then, on July 8th, in an edition of the Sunday Herald, it had suggested a headline as follows, quote, "A Mad Strangler is loose in Boston," end quote, in an article titled, quote, "Mad Strangler kills 4 women in Boston," end quote. The killer was also known as the Phantom Fiend, I like the alliteration, or Phantom Strangler, due to his ability to get women to allow him into the apartments, into their apartments. Yeah, right. Yeah.
He'd be like Candygram from Mongo.
land shark. Oh, honey, it's a land shark. Let him in.
So he'd be like, I'm here to fix the sink, basically.
Yeah.
Or he had a little bit in your bathroom, and they'd be like, I didn't get that. Right. Well, all right, I can come back, but I don't know when. And then they'd let him in.
So in 1963, two investigative reporters for the Record American, Gene Cole and Loretta McLaughlin, wrote a 4-part series. The Record American.
Oh, yeah. I know the Record American.
You remember? I know. Yeah. See? A local. He's a local. No, that's why you're here. Loretta McLaughlin wrote a 4-part series about the killer, dubbing him the Boston Strangler. By the time that DeSalvo's confession was aired in open court, the name Boston Strangler had become part of crime lore.
Now, between June 14th of 1962 and January 4th of 1964, 13 single women between the ages of 19 and 85 were murdered in the Boston area, and most were sexually assaulted and strangled in their apartments. Now, police believe that one man was the perpetrator, and with no sign of forced entry into their homes, the women were assumed to have just let the assailant in, either because they knew him or they believed him to be the apartment maintenance man, Mario, delivery man, or other service man, and the attacks continued despite extensive media publicity. After the first few murders, which presumably you would think would have discouraged women from admitting strangers into their homes, but many residents
still did.
And many residents in the area, they purchased tear gas, new locks, deadbolts for their doors. And some women actually moved out of the area. Now, the murders occurred in several cities, including Boston, complicating jurisdictional oversight for prosecution of the crimes. Massachusetts Attorney General Edward W. Brooke helped to coordinate various police forces. He permitted parapsychologist Peter Hercos to use his alleged extrasensory perception to analyze the cases, for which Hercos claimed that a single person was responsible. The decision was controversial, obviously, and Hercos provided a, quote, "minutely detailed description of the wrong person," and the press ridiculed Brooke. The police were not convinced that all the murders were the actions of one person, although much of the public believed so. The apparent connections between a majority of the victims and hospitals had been widely discussed.
Now, we're going to go on to the victims here and the crimes committed, so let that be your trigger warning, listeners, because, of course, it's not pleasant. And we're going to talk about the locations where they occurred, and this is where I want to note with you, Mario, how there's a wide gap, not only among the age of the victims, but also from the different areas. Some of them, there's quite a difference in the socioeconomic neighborhoods where the crimes took place. You know, some are in the Beacon Hill area, which is which is a nicer area of town. And then,
very nice.
No offense to Dorchester. I had a boyfriend in Dorchester, but you know, Dorchester.
Yeah. I lived in Beacon Hill.
Well, yeah.
And I lived in Beacon Hill.
You did.
It's very different. What'd you say, Mario?
I lived in Beacon Hill too. I lived at 44 Phillips Street.
Oh, my
junior and senior year of college.
Well, yeah, so I for 8 weeks. It was the best time.
No, I wasn't on tour.
And
you were on tour?
I was.
Beacon Hill while you were doing the Wicked, right?
I was.
I went to the Boston Conservatory of Music, and some of them take place on the Fenway, and you know, Palm Ave, Huntington Ave. So I'm like, oh my God, that's, you know, anyway.
But it was usually an apartment building, right? It was usually an apartment building, so he could buzz.
Yeah, yeah. But some of them took place, I don't know if they were apartments, but, you know, other towns far away. We're going to get there, but Salem, Massachusetts, or Lawrence, Massachusetts. Yeah. So, all right. So here are some, with all due respect to the victims, here we go. Anna Elsa Leggins Slessers was 56 years old. She was sexually assaulted with an unknown object and strangled with the belt on her bathrobe. She was found on June 14th, as Mario told us, in 1962, in her third floor apartment at 77 Gainsborough Street, Fenway.
That's the Fenway.
Mary Mullen, aged 85, died from a heart attack. She was found on June 28, 1962, also in 62, in her apartment at 1435 Commonwealth Ave, Boston. In his confession, DeSalvo said she collapsed as he grabbed her.
Ugh. She was 85. I know. Really? What are you doing?
Honestly, what are you doing?
Horrifying. Nina Francis.
That's like that scene in The Other. Did you ever see The Other?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you ever see the movie The Other, where the kid with not The Others with Nicole Kidman, The Other with Uta Hagen?
No.
The twins, good twin bed. It's a great movie. But the kid goes next door to scare the old lady Rowan. He dressed as a musician, magician, and he pulls a rat out of his hat, and she has a heart attack and dies.
Oh God.
So kind of the same thing. Go ahead.
Nina Frances Nichols, age 68, was sexually assaulted and strangled with her nylon stockings. She was found on June 30th, 1962, in her home at 1940 Commonwealth Ave, Boston. Mm-hmm. Helen Elizabeth Blake, age 65, sexually assaulted and strangled with her nylon stockings, was found on June 30th, 1962, in her home at 73 Newell Street, Lynn, Massachusetts.
Lynn.
And Ms. Ida Odes Erga, age 75, was sexually assaulted and strangled, found on August 19th, 1962, in her apartment at 7 Grove Street, Beacon Hill, Boston. That's right, near you, right?
Yep.
Jane Buckley Sullivan, age 67, sexually assaulted and strangled with her nylon stockings, found on August 21st, 1962, in her home at 435 Columbia Road, Dorchester, Boston. Sophie Clark, age 20, was sexually assaulted and strangled with her nylon stockings. She was found on December 5th, 1962, in her apartment at 315 Huntington Ave, Fenway, Boston. Patricia Jane Bullock Bissett, age 23, strangled with her nylon stockings, found on December 31st, 1962, in her home at Park Drive, Fenway, Boston. Marianne Brown, 69, raped, strangled, beaten, and stabbed, found on March 6, 1963, in her apartment at 319 Park Street, Lawrence, Massachusetts. Beverly Sammons, 25, stabbed to death, found on May 6, 1963, in her home at 4 University Road in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Marie Evelina, otherwise known as Evelyn Corbin, 58, raped and strangled with her nylon stockings, found on September 8, 1963, in her home at 224 Lafayette Street, Salem, Massachusetts.
I'm just going Salem.
Me too, and it's far away from Boston. It's like an hour
east. From Boston, it's about 35 minutes, 40 minutes. I stay in Beverly a lot when I go home.
I've been to Beverly. My old voice teacher was in Beverly. I know.
The North Shore Musical Theater.
Joanne Marie.
It still is.
I know. Joanne Marie Graff, age 22, strangled with her nylon stockings, found on November 23rd, 1963, in her apartment at 54 Essex Street, Lawrence, Massachusetts. Mary Ann Sullivan.
That's far from Salem.
Lawrence.
Those are far.
Those are far.
Lawrence and Salem?
Yeah. Mary Ann Sullivan, 19, sexually assaulted and strangled with nylon stockings, found on January 4th, 1964, in her apartment at 44A Charles Street, Boston. And finally, the murders of Margaret Davis, 60, of Roxbury, and Cheryl Laird, 14, of Lawrence, were originally attributed to the Boston Strangler, but were later found to be unrelated cases.
Damn.
So, and then he finally got caught because his last victim... And she bit his hand, but then supposedly he said, "I'm sorry," and left.
What are you reading my mind? I literally am just gonna. We were just gonna tell our listeners that this happened. The girl you were talking about happened on October 27th, 1964. So a stranger, quote unquote, entered a young woman's home and he posed as a detective. And he said he tied the victim to the bed, sexually assaulted her, and then suddenly left, saying, "I'm sorry," and. Yeah. The woman's description of the attacker, obviously she survived, it led police to identify the assailant as DeSalvo. And when his photo was published, thank prize Jesus, many women identified him as the man who had assaulted them. And earlier on October 27th, DeSalvo had posed as a motorist with car trouble. He attempted to enter a home in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. And the homeowner, future Brockton Police Chief Richard Sprowls, became suspicious and eventually fired a shotgun at DeSalvo. And DeSalvo was not initially suspected of being involved with the strangling murders. And after he was charged with rape, he gave a detailed confession of his activities as the Boston Strangler, which, by the way, y'all, is why I think I'm so into the psychology of crime.
Yeah.
Because obviously this guy was proud of, or must have been an achievement for him.
Yeah. And I think he's the way, you know, I watched the movie with Tony Curtis, and the way Curtis portrayed him is like when he finally kind of confessed, it was like, it was all in his head. And the way Curtis portrayed him, it seemed really fucked up about it, and like he was another person when he did it, like he was in another head. I don't know who knows what he was like.
Yeah,
but that woman bit his hand.
Well, so here's what happens. He initially confessed to a fellow inmate named George Nassar.
Right.
And Nassar reported the confession to his attorney, F. Lee Bailey, who also took on the defense of DeSalvo. And the police were pretty impressed with the accuracy of DeSalvo's description of the crime scenes.
Right.
There were minor inconsistencies, but DeSalvo was able to cite details that were absolutely withheld from the public. But here's the thing. No physical evidence substantiated his confession. And because of that, he was tried on charges for earlier unrelated crimes of robbery and sexual offenses, for which he was known as, I mean, this man has so many, the Green Man and the Measuring Man, respectively. Bailey brought up DeSalvo's confession to the murders as part of his client's history at the trial in order to assist in gaining a, quote, not guilty by reason of insanity verdict to the sexual offenses, but it was ruled as inadmissible by the judge. So there you have it.
But then he was sentenced to life prison.
Yes. Are you a psychic? You're literally a psychic.
This is literally the next sentence, Mario. Dr. Cantone is incredible. You are psychic.
Yeah.
I love it.
But absolutely.
I was just confused about why he got life for sexual assaults, right?
Yes.
He did.
Yes.
Several other crimes. Robbery.
Okay.
Yeah.
Robbery. You don't get life for robbery.
Right.
You get life for sexual assaults, you should. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, but they were saying it was prior crimes, not the ones specifically accused by the quote unquote Boston Strangler, is my understanding. Is that doctors? Is that your understanding from what we just heard?
Yes. It is.
I would say yes, doc.
Yeah. All right. So, DeSalvo it reminds me of earlier. What is that thing we wrote? I have to find it because we edit this thing. I can take the pauses out. What's that guy that they hired? The parapsychologist.
Oh, was Mario.
So Mario is a parapsychologist, Mario Cantone.
Yeah. Yes, he is. He knew. I was going to say the same thing.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me. Best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep, that's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors, trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevvies too. Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
That's what you are. So, as you just heard from parapsychologist Dr. Mario Cantone, DeSalvo was...
You imagine.
DeSalvo was sentenced to life in prison in 1967. In February of that year, he escaped with two fellow inmates from Bridgewater State Hospital, triggering a full-scale manhunt. A note was found...
Because they put him in like the insane asylum.
That's right.
I call it the nutty bin at Bridgewater State, because they knew he was nuts. They knew he was crazy.
Oh,
it was very evident that he was out of his mind. Not just, he wasn't like a sane murderer. He wasn't like this clear-cut... He was emotionally really fucking disturbed.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
So this is where he was in Bridgewater.
That's right. So a note.
So he escaped.
He escaped with two other fellas. And a note was found on his bunk addressed to the superintendent. In it, DeSalvo stated that he had escaped to focus attention on the conditions in the hospital and his own situation. Immediately after his escape, DeSalvo disguised himself as a U.S. Navy petty officer, third class, to do a production of On the Town. I'm just kidding, you guys. I had to throw that in. What? I mean, that's really specific. So he's.
I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
He had a lot of costumes, this guy. Yeah,
tap shoes.
Honestly, though.
Right? But yeah, tap shoes, they're going to hear you. It's not a good choice. Anyway, he disguised himself as U.S. Navy Petty Officer, third class. But the next day, he gave himself up. Following the escape, he was transferred to the maximum security Walpole State Prison. 6 years after the transfer, he was found stabbed to death in the prison infirmary, as you heard from parapsychologist Dr. Cantone earlier. His killer or killers were never identified.
And what's interesting is that when once he finally got caught in that, and he didn't kill that last victim, and she identified him, it took a while, but they put him in the hospital in the kind of insane ward, the nutty bin, and as I like to call it, he went to the nutty bin, and he finally confessed. I mean, he finally kind of went through it in his mind. He confessed to a fellow inmate, but. I think when they had him under questioning, he went through some vague, not vague confession, but he did kind of allude to it a little bit, I think, too. And then he gave himself up the next day. He was so fucked up. And I think he was like done. He was like, okay. He knew he did it. Of course he did it. And I think he was exhausted.
Oh, sure. I think that there's something that must have clicked that said, I just cannot do this anymore. I can't run from this anymore.
Absolutely.
And to be honest, I always love talking about the fact that DNA came into play. I mean, so much later, and it, obviously, thank God.
So much later.
Thank God, because the DNA confirmation happened here in 2013. So the deal is, all of these years had gone by where they didn't have these databases, they didn't have the proper DNA to actually, you know, to say that this suspect is the person who absolutely, without a doubt, is the one who committed these crimes. So doubts existed as to whether he actually was the Boston Strangler until 2013, because at the time he confessed, people who knew him personally, they were like, this kid, he couldn't do that. No, he could not be such a vicious, heinous guy. He could not commit these crimes. So it created tons of doubt within the community. I'm sure there was a rift in what people thought about this guy, and the doubt was of the serial killer who characteristically has a certain type of victim and method of murder. And the women killed by the strangler were from such a variety of age and ethnic groups.
All over the place.
And in 1968, Dr. Jen, tell me if I get this wrong, because you know me, Dr. Ames Roby, medical director of Bridgewater State Hospital, insisted that DeSalvo was not the Boston Strangler. He said the prisoner was, quote, a very clever, very smooth, compulsive confessor who desperately needs to be recognized. So his opinion was shared by Middlesex District Attorney John J. Droney, Bridgewater Superintendent Charles Gohan.
I
is that right?
I texted you that. Yeah.
I know you did, Jen, but I don't I don't remember.
Oh, sorry.
I can't remember.
I'm pausing to give myself remembrance myself. It's Gohan. Gohan. Like Han Solo. Gohan.
Thank you. But let me tell you what, Jen always helps me out here, because sometimes I get the tongue twisters of the century in our podcast. So she texted me today and I read it and I said, Jessica, thank God. And now I don't remember. So Charles Gohan and George W. Harrison, a former fellow inmate of DeSalvo's. Harrison claimed to have overheard another convict coaching DeSalvo about details of the strangling murders. DeSalvo's attorney, Bailey, believed that his client was the killer.
Yeah.
And described the case in the book, The Defense Never Rests. Susan Kelly, author of the book, The Boston Stranglers, drew from the files of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Strangler Bureau. She argues that the murders were the work of several killers rather than a single individual. Now, former FBI profiler Robert Ressler said, quote, you're putting together so many different patterns regarding the Boston Strangler murders that it's inconceivable behaviorally that all of these could fit one individual. John E. Douglas, the former FBI special agent who was one of the first criminal profilers, doubted that DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. And in his book, The Cases That Haunt Us, he identified DeSalvo as a, quote, power assurance motivated rapist. And he said that such a rapist is unlikely to kill in the manner of crimes attributed to the Boston Strangler. A powerful assurance motivated rapist would, however, be prone to taking credit for the crimes. What?
neck. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in 2000, attorney and former print journalist Elaine Sharp took up the cause of the DeSalvo family and that of the family of Mary Sullivan. Sullivan was the one publicized as being the final victim in 1964, although there were other strangling murders that occurred after that date. Sharp assisted the families in their media campaign to clear DeSalvo's name, and she helped organize and arrange the exhumations of Mary Sullivan and Albert H. DeSalvo, filed various lawsuits in attempt to obtain information and trace evidence, like DNA, from the government, and worked with various producers to create documentaries to explain the facts to the public. Sharp noticed various inconsistencies between DeSalvo's confessions and the crime scene information, which she somehow obtained. And for example, she observed that, contrary to DeSalvo's confession to Sullivan's murder, the woman was found to have no semen in her vagina, and she was not strangled manually but by ligature. Now, forensic pathologist Michael Baden noted that DeSalvo got the time of death wrong. This was a common inconsistency also pointed out by Susan Kelly in several of the murders, which she continues to work on the case for the DeSalvo family. I still think he did it.
Oh, of course he did. And, you know, but the DeSalvo family, his brother Joe, and even his, I think, his nephew Frankie, that family fought to clear his name. Mm-hmm. They really fought to clear his name. They exhumed the bodies because they were like, enough of this shit. We need to know. The DNA exists.
Yeah.
We should have done this a few years ago when it, you know, they first started using DNA. So yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So they did it. They did it in 2013.
They did.
When they finally did this.
Yeah, they did, exactly. On July 11th, as a matter of fact, of that year, the Boston Police Department released information stating that they had found DNA evidence which linked DeSalvo to the murder of Mary Sullivan. DNA found at the scene was a near certain match to Y-DNA taken from a nephew of DeSalvo. You just brought up his family.
That's for maybe that's Frankie.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Y-DNA.
Frankie DeSalvo.
What is that?
Frankie DeSalvo. Oh. Frankie DeSalvo. What are you doing, cuz? Hey, Frankie.
Come over for Sunday dinner.
Y-DNA, for those of you who don't know, we doctors will now tell you, it is passed through the direct male lines with little change and can be used to link males with a common paternal line ancestor. To determine that it was DeSalvo's DNA, a court ordered the exhumation of his body in order to test his DNA directly. And so finally, on July 19th, 2013, Suffolk County District Attorney Daniel F. Conley, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley, and Boston Police Commissioner Edward F. Davis announced the DNA test results proving that DeSalvo was the source of seminal fluid recovered at the scene of Sullivan's 1964 murder. And that...
So wait,
yes.
What if two brothers are accused of murder and one of them is like, one of them did it and the other one didn't? How do you find out through DNA which one did it? If it's through the male line, this DNA, they tested his nephew? That is very bizarre to me. How would you know which brother did it? Say there's two brothers.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is actually a case. We discussed a case recently where because of the time that the crime was in the 70s, right? They couldn't get proper DNA until all these years later. And the DNA that they got in the system came back to three brothers, and it was DNA that matched these three brothers. Right. And it's basically trial and error of getting them into a room. I mean, honestly, it's right. That familial DNA is obviously something, thank God, that somebody was in the system that shared the DNA with this person, the same last name. And I believe that in this particular case that we discussed, the police and detectives rummaged through the garbage of these gentlemen, and the one piece of evidence that they got out of the garbage of this one guy matched exactly.
So one of them matched exactly.
That's correct.
And the other two just kind of all matched mostly.
The other two were not a direct match for the two brothers. Yes. So it came back like the profile was the three brothers. Yeah. And then once they got that specific DNA,
it wound up being... So DNA can be much more specific.
Y'all, that is the case of the Boston Strangler in a one-part, not nine-part series, because nobody needs that shit.
Yeah, no one needs fucking 8 episodes. Just do it.
You guys, I wanted your feedback on something. So you know how they said former agents Ressler and Douglas, whom we love, right? The Mindhunter series is based on the work of these two gentlemen. When they were saying, oh, it sounds like different people, I grant you that. We went over 13 of the victims, but I didn't really realize it as we were typing this, Jessica, until having to very slowly in great detail describe the murders, but no less than 7 of the victims that I just talked about were strangled with their stockings. I almost stopped to say, I'm going to just stop saying strangled with their stockings because it literally was so many of them.
All of them, yeah. I mean, seven of them were with the stocking, but like if a silk stocking's not available, he's going to kill them with something else.
Yeah.
So he's strangling most of them. So isn't that enough consistency?
Right. And also, we got to the point, we had it said as a group that earlier he sounded like he wanted to take credit. And then someone said it couldn't be him because this is the kind of guy that would want to take credit. And I was like, but we just talked about the fact that he wanted, like, he did take credit. He did admit it.
He did take credit. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think he did. I mean, I conclude he absolutely, especially after the DNA. But But he was creepy. He was weird. He's a weird dude. And he was married and he had two kids.
Oh, that's they often always, the that's case. The thing they always do.
He had two kids.
They hide in plain sight.
Married. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think he was living in Malden at the time when all this was happening.
You said something earlier too. You said the family, the DeSalvo family worked hard to get him off. And it just made me think.
They did.
It just made me think, of course they did. And, you know, there are lots of victims here. Of course, the undisputed victims are the victims themselves, but also their families and the family of DeSalvo. Like, they're a victim in this too, right? How horrifying.
Yeah. And one of them, I forget who it was. My cousin was telling me to change his name. And
wow. But you know, I guess that doesn't surprise me either. If you feel so stigmatized by the entire situation.
And I think they were trying to get Frankie, his nephew, to change his name. And Frankie was like, no, I'm not changing it. This is people that know me know who I am, and I'm not going to change my name.
Frankie. All right.
Frank.
Well, Mario, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a delight.
Oh, I'm so happy that you did this with us. Thank
me too.
You.
This is a big thank one, you. And to have thank someone of your stature here is quite something. We.
Big.
You are, my friend.
I work with the big.
Let me tell you what. You were on my television last night as I watch E! When I watch my Sex in the City episodes, okay?
Yeah.
Because I'm that bitch who watches them 62 times in a row, and I don't care.
You know, I can't watch them because I don't want to see myself 15 years ago when I was really pretty.
Oh, honey.
You're still pretty. You're gorgeous.
All
right, so in my New England...
That's my Omen soundtrack imitation. My favorite.
Oh, my God. Thank well, I'll God see you in here. Boston one day, and we'll go have some chowder, and it'll be great.
When this is over, we'll see each other for sure. All right, girls?
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Bye,
this was really fun.
Thanks.
Ahu hee hoo. Bye. Happy holidays.
Happy ho-ho holidays.
He's the funniest, Jess. I love him so much.
Oh, he's a dream. He's a dream.
He's a dream.
In every frickety frackety way, he's a
frickety frickety frack. I like that.
You know, I want to keep it classy. I'm going to keep it a little classy. And I'm just so glad that he was here because it's an insane case to discuss, especially when it's an abridged version like we just did. So, and he again, another person that came so prepared.
You know what I should have said to him though. Now it's like Mario, sign back on. I think he'd be great. In the role of Son of Sam.
For sure.
I hate to say that because that's, I don't know if that would
well,
be
don't
taken
hate
as
to
a
say,
compliment.
I think let's talk to him. Let's have a talk with him. We'll talk. Mm-hmm. We're going to call his people and we'll have a talk.
You know, like in Mindhunter, they cast a fine fella. What is Son of Sam's real life name? I know it usually and I don't remember.
I'm not going to be able to figure it.
David Berkowitz. I don't know if that's a compliment, but I could really see him as just this New Yorker, and
I think it's wonderful.
I'd cast him in everything, is what I'm trying to say. Not every dramatic actor can do comedy, but I do believe that every comedic actor can do drama.
Well,
I do.
I think that we would be lucky to see Mario in anything. And and for all of you listening today, we are so glad that you're here with us. We are so glad that you enjoyed our pal Mario. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.